Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled For Caregivers, Care Coordination for Your Loved One Living with Cancer and Other Health Care or Other Health Problems, excuse me. This program is supported by the Anna Fuller Fund, and I really want to thank them for the support of today's activity. Now, just to start, I want to let everyone know how many people we have on the call. We have over 230 participants from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Aaron Kent. And Dr. Kent is an associate professor and associate chair for research in health policy and management at the UNC Chapel Hill Gillings School of Global Public Health. He's also a member of the Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center and a health services research fellow at the Cecil G. Shepps Center. And Dr. Kent will be discussing the role of caregivers in care coordination for people living with cancer and comorbidities, as well as what research tells us about caregivers, including long-distance caregivers. It's my great pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Kent.
Thank you so much, Johnny. I'm really honored to be with you all today on this important teleconference, and I'm just so grateful to Cancer Care for continuing this series. It reaches so many people. And I first want to indicate that, as Johnny indicated in my introduction, that I am a researcher and a faculty member in the Gillings School of Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill, and my work does focus on the impact that cancer has on families and caregivers. But I'm not a clinician, and so I don't have experience in providing direct medical or psychosocial care. My role today instead is to tell you about what the research tells us about being a family caregiver for someone with cancer and other chronic conditions. And this is really a very important topic. A survey conducted by Cancer Care in the past found that the impact that cancer can have on family was the number one concern of cancer patients, indicating how critically important it is that we pay attention to cancer patients' families in addition to patients themselves. So I first want to talk about what we mean by caregivers. So caregivers are people with cancer. Caregivers are people with cancer, maybe spouses, they could be partners or children. They could also include other relatives, friends, neighbors, or coworkers. They really could be any sort of relational role. Caregivers are the people who help their patients, their care recipients meet their day-to-day needs, what we often refer to as activities of daily living. This could include really fundamental tasks like feeding, dressing, bathing, moving around. But it can also include instrumental tasks at more of a distance, so things like shopping for groceries, paying bills, and helping with finances. Tasks that caregivers can help with also include what we might call medical or nursing tasks, like administering medication, changing bandages, and helping with things like infusion ports and catheters. Caregivers can help by accompanying their loved ones to medical appointments, communicating and coordinating with healthcare providers, and sometimes advocating for services. That all said, many people might not refer to themselves as caregivers. They might be actually doing the work of caregiving, but not call themselves a caregiver. It's not a term that resonates with everyone, but it is helpful sometimes for healthcare providers and researchers like me to use that term to recognize all of the critically important ways in which someone might support a loved one with a serious health problem like cancer. And we know that there can be many challenging aspects of being a caregiver, particularly for those who are caregiving for several hours a week or more and helping out with many, many tasks. Cancer caregiving tends to be more episodic, means that it might not be as long-lasting as caring for someone with other kinds of health conditions like, for example, dementia. Not everyone reports feeling like they had a choice in taking on this responsibility. Obligation and a sense of purpose can go hand in hand, but we do know that people feel people who feel like they had a choice, that they didn't have a choice, sorry, in taking this on can lead to additional stress and strain. And what that can mean for someone considering stepping into that role is that choice matters, and taking on this role needs to be viewed for that lens of adjustment. So if you're becoming a caregiver, it might be important to take some time to process what is happening, what it means for you in your life and schedule, and setting and revisiting goals with your loved one is crucial. Caregiving does not have to be a singular endeavor. There are many ways to marshal support, from asking for help from additional family members or friends, and there are tools to help organize requests, tasks, schedules, and expectations. Now more than ever, and especially in the setting of feeling like one is obligated to be a caregiver, it's the time to activate whatever village you might have. In addition, it's important to be able to communicate with the healthcare team that your loved one is getting care from and navigating this transition to becoming a caregiver. So caregivers can play a significant role in communicating with healthcare teams, as I've mentioned, appointment scheduling, really understanding and having clear medication regimens and treatment plans, helping with managing symptoms and side effects can be difficult in the best of circumstances, but even more so when someone doesn't feel well, either from their cancer treatment or another comorbidity or co-occurring condition. Cancer patients with a dedicated caregiver, someone willing and able to come with them to medical appointments and be able to assist, even with just listening and taking notes during appointments, can be enormously helpful. Caregivers can ask about recording conversations with the healthcare team. Many times teams will permit this. And despite this involvement, many cancer caregivers, our research shows, that have not had conversations with doctors, nurses, and other care providers about their own needs. And many also feel that they don't have proper preparation to perform complex medical or nursing tasks. So it's highly important to ask and advocate to get that kind of help and training. And there's also many ways to assist loved ones with decision-making. That can be about receiving treatment and either go ahead and start treatment or to wait, to think about which treatments are the right ones to pursue. There's new and evolving research about the best ways clinicians can help cancer patients and their families with making decisions. And sometimes this is categorized under the heading of shared decision making. And a key component of patient-centered healthcare is a process where clinicians and patients and caregivers work together to make decisions, select tests and treatments, and the best care plans based on the best clinical evidence that we have that balances risks and expected outcomes with patient preferences and values. I want to point out that the Mayo Clinic has a guide that lists 5 steps for shared decision making. I'll share those here. Step 1 is decide how much you want to know. Get help by asking questions. Number 2 is decide how you want to make your treatment decisions. Number 3 is having realistic expectations. And number 4 is keeping the focus on your values and preferences. And then number 5 is accepting help. So these are geared towards patients, but this can be a process that caregivers and patients go through together. There's always choices when it comes to cancer treatment, and it's important to balance being patient and listening and being active by advocating for your loved ones as you can. I was also asked to address long-distance caregiving or caregiving at a distance. This is a topic near and dear to my heart as I currently, my mother lives with me half of the year or lives in my town half the year and the other half of the year lives across the country. So I know all too well how the distance can be challenging in helping support our loved ones, whatever the health problems they might have. But there's multiple ways to care for loved ones with cancer from afar. Many of these strategies can rely on technology. Video conferencing through platforms like Zoom or FaceTime can be very helpful in terms of attending visits and even checking in on a loved one and getting to see their face and their home environment, where they're living. Taking pictures and texting or emailing them pictures of medicines can help answer questions. Setting up supportive services, whether they're formal services like home health or informal, like arranging with groups of friends to provide companionship or bring over meals or help with house and yard work, can be very helpful. There are some digital and online tools to help caregivers organize their care and get additional help from additional caregivers or additional supporters. And these can be there's a lot of programs out there, but I'll mention 2. One is called Caring Bridge, and another one is called Lots of Helping Hands. And these are freely available tools on the internet to help organize care, create lists of tasks and schedules and requests for help, emailing social networks, and getting people to sign up for things like meal delivery, picking up kids, yard work, taking someone to and from appointments, and so forth. So these sites help organize that assistance and allowing the help to be more efficiently spread out. And in our increasingly busy world, this kind of instrumental support can really be a huge stress reliever. So if you are a distance caregiver helping support someone that is caregiving close to your loved ones with cancer, helping to establish a system like this is something that can be done at a distance and actually managed at a distance as well. So with that, I'll wrap. Thank you for listening, and I'm happy to provide further resources, and I'll hand it back to Johnny.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kent. You were our first speaker today, so you really set the stage for this workshop. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and I want to thank you again. And our next speaker is Dr. Lisa Thompson, and Dr. Thompson is the Oncology Pharmacy Program Director for Banner Pharmacy Services at Banner Health. And Dr. Thompson will be discussing adherence, taking pills on schedule, as well as planning ahead with your pharmacist, lead time in refilling prescriptions, and planning for weekends, travel, and holidays. And I'm going to hand the line over to Dr. Thompson.
Thank you so much. So again, my name is Lisa Thompson, and I will be talking to you a little bit about adherence and some ways that the pharmacist can help you in your cancer journey. So one thing I'd like to point out is that in my career path, pharmacists can actually specialize in certain areas. So I actually had additional training in the area of oncology. There are pharmacists in so many touch points in your lives. You know, we have clinicians that are working directly in clinics or in the hospital right there with the oncologist. And we also have, you know, our retail pharmacists that are readily available. So as a member of your healthcare team, do not hesitate to reach out. We can oftentimes get you the answer or help get you to the right person if we don't know the answer. So with regards to adherence and trying to take your medications on time, some things that you need to think about are what barriers might be in place to taking your medications. So one of those could be, you know, do you still work? Do you care for other people in your family? Are you a caregiver for children, for elderly parents, for other people? Or are your caregivers needing to help you take your medications, and what are their schedules look like? So definitely take that into consideration, that you might need to think about things like, you know, if you work at night, if you tend to fall asleep early. You know, some of us might, you know, I think we're probably all guilty of it, watching TV at night and we fall asleep. So is it a medication that you need to take, you know, at bedtime? So think about your schedule and your habits and how that might impact your ability to take your medication once you find out how often that medication is going to be taken. Is it once a day, twice a day, or more often? Another thing to think about is how are you organizing your medications? Now might be a good time to get a pill box, depending on how many medications you're taking, and stay organized. I know, like, for example, my father-in-law, if he comes over to our house for dinner, he has medications that he takes at dinner time. And so he'll have a little baggie that he brings with him to take his pills, so he makes sure he's still taking them on time. So think about things that you can do to keep yourself and your medications organized. Another thing is the cost of the medication. And I would be open and transparent about that with your healthcare team. You know, how expensive is it? Are there resources from the manufacturer or other avenues that can help bring down the cost of your medication? Or is there an alternative that might be cheaper if the medication is not affordable for you or going to result in barriers? You should never, you know, reduce the dose of your medication or skip days because of cost. Another thing that might impact some people is how many pills do you have to take at a time? Is it a medication where it's just one pill? Is it a medication where you have to take three at the same time? You know, are they big? Are they hard to swallow? Does it taste bad? Things like that. So these are all things to consider when it comes to taking your medication. So definitely be open and transparent with your healthcare team. We can only help you if you're letting us know what's going on. So please be open and honest. And as previously mentioned, bring your support team with you, or, you know, have them call in like previously mentioned as well, so that they can help support you in taking those medications on time and reminding you as well. So don't be afraid to ask for help, whether it's from family, friends, or your healthcare team. We want to make sure you're taking your medications on time so that we get the best medical outcome that we can have possible. And then other things to consider is planning ahead with your pharmacist and lead times. So with that being said, you know, let's always think about, you know, weekends coming up. Let's try to avoid the, you know, 3 o'clock I just looked at my pills and realized that I'm running out. By all means, if that happens, please do call. But the earlier that you can inform us, the better it'll be for you and for us so that nobody's scrambling at the last minute. Typically, you can refill a prescription 7 days in advance of when you last filled, like if it's a monthly cycle, 7 days ahead of that. So that's something to take into consideration as well. If you're traveling, let us know. Maybe there's a way that we can give you a longer duration for that prescription, like a 90-day supply. Sometimes that's not possible, but sometimes it is. So just again, communication is the main thing. Same thing with holidays, because there might be reduced hours at your pharmacy or for the clinic setting as well. And always check to see how many refills you have on your prescription as well. Maybe you don't need to call the clinic to get more of your medication. Maybe it's just a simple facet of you can get a refill on your own, depending on what type of medication it is. So there's lots of different ways to think about that, and just making sure, again, open communication. Dose simplification is very important too, to make sure that you are successful in taking your medication. So just remember that communication is key, whether it be to being adherent or to planning ahead for any types of trips or weekends or things like that that might come into play. So thank you so much for letting me have the time to talk to you all today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thompson. And our next speaker is Dr. Sylvia Ritchie. And Dr. Ritchie is Chief Medical Officer, Medical Oncology, Hematology at West Cancer Center and Research Institute. And Dr. Ritchie will be discussing coordinating follow-up appointments and strategies to communicate more effectively with the healthcare team. Now going to turn this program over to Dr. Ritchie.
Thank you so much. As I was introduced, I am a medical oncologist, and I am on an active care team for the cancer patient. And so in the next few minutes, what I wanted to do is share some practical tips to help you coordinate follow-up appointments and communicate clearly with the healthcare team so concerns get addressed early and you feel more confident speaking up as a caregiver. As we talked about earlier, the role of the caregiver oftentimes is like an air traffic controller. But at the same time, you don't need to feel like you have to do everything perfectly. Your goal is actually to help information flow smoothly. So one of the big parts of that is really coordinating follow-up appointments. And I think the most important thing for you to understand when coordinating those appointments is you need to understand what needs follow-up and why you need the follow-up. And I think really there are big categories of follow-up, and you can put them into three big buckets. One of them is the cancer-related care. So that's going to be your oncology visits, chemotherapy, and immunotherapy appointments, radiology, labs. And then the second bucket would be your non-cancer care. So that's going to be primary care visits and any other subspecialty visits like cardiology or pulmonology visits you may have. Then you have the third bucket of your supportive care services. So those are things like palliative care visits, nutrition, social work, physical therapy, home health, you know, any of those things. So you need to sort of keep those three buckets of your follow-up appointments in your mind to keep them separated, and that way you know what may or may not take priority. The best way to do that is to keep a master appointment system. You need to choose one trusted method and let that be your source of truth for any appointment, whether it's a smartphone calendar, a paper planner, or even a shared family calendar. Everything needs to go into one place so you can really see what the overall picture looks like of all those appointments. When you put the appointment down, put the location and the purpose. So, for example, you might want to put CT chest, oncology. So you know that it's going to be your oncology bucket and your oncology team that's going to be following up on that test. Or it could be echocardiogram cardiology, and then you know where you're going for that appointment. Add reminders. Put the reminders. You may need them a week ahead of time. You may need them just 24 hours ahead of time. But more importantly, when appointments don't happen as planned, then feel free to reach out, okay? Care coordination teams exist because the system is complicated. It's not complicated on purpose. It's that the care of a cancer patient is complicated. It's not because you're doing something wrong, but so always reach out to those teams. Sometimes things get rescheduled, and you just need to let that primary oncology team be aware that, hey, I didn't get my CT scan because they called and the scanner was down, but I know our appointment is tomorrow. Do we need to reschedule things? So don't be afraid to reach out when things don't happen as planned. Part of communicating more effectively with the healthcare team really has to do with being prepared. So I would suggest preparing for every visit you have with your oncology team. And an easy way to do that is sort of have this three-question visit prep for you and the patient. Those questions are, what symptoms or changes have occurred since the last visit? What treatments, number two, what treatments or medications have changed since the last visit? And number three, what tests or appointments are coming up next? At those visits, always, I encourage all my patients to have a notebook. We actually give our patients a notebook when they become a new patient, but keep a notebook. Whatever is easiest for you, it could be digital or not, but keep all of those questions that you may have in between visits, keep that appointment list, and most importantly, keep that medication list and bring it with you. The next thing that's really important for communication is to know who the team is. You need to understand the roles of the people on that team, not necessarily the names. So you need to know that you have an oncologist. Maybe there's a nurse practitioner, a nurse, a nurse navigator, a care coordinator, a pharmacist, a social worker. Different team members handle different problems, so knowing who to contact really saves time. When you're contacting that care team, it's important that you understand the right channel of communication to use at the right time. So, for example, if the patient's having fever or confusion or shortness of breath, that's a phone call. A medication refill, non-urgent symptom question, that's a portal message. A scheduling issue, that goes to a scheduler. Portals are fantastic and they're great, but they are not for emergencies. So it's important to know when to actually pick up the phone and go through that probable complex triage system that the office may have. When you're communicating and you have a problem on that phone call, be specific and organized. You know, saying Aunt Jane isn't feeling well is not super helpful to the care team. What they need to know is over the last 24 hours, Aunt Jane has had nausea, she can't keep liquids down, and had a temperature of 100.6. What do we need to do? So having those specific information can really, really help that care team. And most importantly, it's okay to speak up. It's really important that you know you can talk, you can interrupt, it's fine. Ask for clarification. Ask the provider to repeat instructions back to you if you don't feel like you got them the first time. And you're also allowed to ask for written instructions. Just say, okay, can you guys write that down for me so I can take it with me so you can digest and you know it's written exactly correct. So what are important phrases that you can use where you don't feel as though you're intrusive? It's things like, can you help me understand XYZ? Or what should I watch for at home? Or who do I call if this or that happens? Or what's the next step if this doesn't improve? Those are all great phrases to ask your providers, and so you have a better idea of what to do next and expectations. You know, I think good care coordination and communication, they don't require medical training at all. And most people don't have medical training, but what they do require is curiosity, organization, and confidence to ask for help. Remember, the healthcare team expects questions, so don't be afraid to be the advocate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ritchie. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Paulos. And Dr. Paulos is former clinical protocol administration manager Office of Cancer Survivorship, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in healthcare disparities, caregiving, and survivorship. And Dr. Paulos will be discussing accessing resources for the cost of care, including home care and time-saving self-care / self-advocacy tips for caregivers. It's my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Paulos.
Thank you, Joni, for that introduction and for inviting me to join this outstanding panel. In the next few minutes, my goals are to share trusted resources for cancer and other common conditions like diabetes or heart disease, and then I'll close with practical reminders about time management while being a caregiver. Studies indicate that reliable information reduces stress and helps you make confident decisions. So let's begin by focusing on cancer resources. You already are familiar with cancer care. Other resources would include the American Cancer Society or the National Cancer Society. Both offer treatment overviews, questions to ask your team, and support navigation. Now, let me just back up for a second here. There's so many different resources. I've tried to keep it to a few of the conditions and about three of the different resources that are there. But remember, this information is going to be available later on the recording. You can call your social worker or even cancer care or one of the others to get the specific information. So if we're talking about diabetes, there's the American Diabetes Association and the National Institute of Diabetes and many other topics after that. Both have practical tools for nutrition, self-management, and tracking medications. Finally, for heart conditions, the American Heart Association and the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute provide services such as educational material for hypertension, stroke prevention, and cardiac rehab guidance, and for caregiving support, which is most important, including things like planning, burnout prevention, and possible financial help, consider the Caregiver Action Network. These groups can also provide general information about home care services. Now, again, these are only a few of the available resources. Your clinic or hospital social worker, case manager, or patient navigator can help you identify resources that are specific to your area or your community. As I said, many of these organizations provide free education, support groups, limited financial assistance, and referrals to mental health counseling. A quick caution, though, avoid relying on random internet searches, especially late at night when anxiety is high and you're exhausted. Start with reputable evidence-based organizations like the ones that I just mentioned. When you are evaluating a source on the internet, look for the person that wrote it, when it was updated, and whether it's tied to a recognized medical or public health organization. Our speakers were excellent and gave some excellent information about the questions to ask. I wrote those down just for future reference for me, too. So you have a lot of information that's already been provided for you. But you do need to be careful about the information that you get. So now I'd like to move on to a self-care check. Many of us are juggling work, family appointments, medications, insurance calls, et cetera, and we still feel like we're falling behind. That's when guilt and frustration show up. So I want to offer a few practical, realistic tips for caregivers and hopefully some that you can start using today. First of all, and I think this is so important, be flexible with your schedule. You can prioritize non-negotiable duties, medication adherence, appointments, hygiene, and meals, and then you can decide what else can wait. For example, if the routine slips by an hour because maybe a clinic visit ran long, or you overslept, or your caregiver had to go to work unexpectedly, that does not mean you failed. It means that you, as the caregiver, adapted to the situation. So don't feel like, you know, don't put yourself on a guilt trip because of this. And it's a normal thing, okay? Random error comes into every situation in our lives on a daily basis. So no matter how well we plan, how well we schedule, we always have that little guy hanging behind us, which is called random error. When you feel overwhelmed, pause and reset. Take a few breaths. You can step outside the room if you're in the hospital. You can step outside for some fresh air if you're at home, or sit quietly for 1 minute. You can do some, again, deep breathing. You can just count to yourself, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Repeat that a few times. That helps kind of start bringing you a little bit more comfortable. And then make time to build your downtime schedule or habits, like reading, gentle exercise. And there's a lot of sitting exercises that are available out there. So you might want to look into that. Take time with your pets. And if you have a favorite dish, cook that. If you like to listen to music, listen to your music. So what you like to do is try to maintain your life to be as normal as possible, given everything else is going kind of haywire around you. Now, a brief personal note. I retired to care for a loved one with cancer, thinking that I'd have so much more time since I didn't have to go to work and be a caregiver. Boy, was I wrong. Even with the oncology experience that I've had, caregiving for someone with cancer and other conditions at the same time can be really overwhelming. I used all the magic tools that are out there, the technology. I even got down to putting stickies all over the place, and I still struggle to complete everything that needed to be done. The bigger lesson, though, that I learned from all this was not which app was the best or which sticky was the best, but that when I was exhausted and my strength was depleted, my patience shrunk and my guilt and frustration grew. And then small problems felt big, like the cat running out of food. Oh, my gosh, that became an emergency. I didn't have anything to do with my caregiving role, but that was a problem. I realized protecting my rest and my support system was not selfish. It made me a steadier caregiver. Ask for help and be specific. You may be surprised by who steps up to help. In my recent caregiving experience, work colleagues of my loved ones, who were all professionals, offered to stay the entire day or night to give relief to our family caregivers. People often want to help but don't know how. So try concrete asks. Can you give me a ride to the help with the treatment? Can you pick up groceries? Self-care, again, is non-negotiable. It can be small. Remember things like drinking water, taking your own medication, going for your prevention procedures, taking a 10-minute walk, of course, prayer or reflection. And you can even give a friend a call just to, change the subject and have some time for you. If you feel guilty, remember the airplane rule. Put your own oxygen mask on first. I'm sure many of you have heard that. It's not because you matter more. It's because you can't help anyone if you're dizzy, exhausted, or unwell. When you are steady, you can make clearer decisions and support everyone else better. Thank you for your time. I'll close by saying you're not alone and support exists. This concludes my remarks, and I'll pass the program back to you, John.
Thank you very much, Dr. Paulos. Thank you for providing all that information and for sharing, drawing from your own personal experience. Just want to say thank you again. And our next speaker is Kate Boskey. And Ms. Boskey is a certified nurse practitioner working in outpatient supportive care at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Ms. Boskey will be discussing tips on choosing community and medical resources to improve your quality of life. It's my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Boskey.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction. One of the things that I've heard speakers say in the past, and it's been said today, is that care is complicated, and you should not be afraid to advocate for what you need as a caregiver and for what the patient needs as well. The options for what's available out there and not knowing what's available can both be very overwhelming. Choosing the right community and medical resources is very important to support quality of life. It involves prioritizing patient-centered care, accessibility, and also assessing for in-network or insurance coverage. Choosing the right care and support to ensure quality of life, sustainability, and financial security for your future. You want to ensure that your medical providers and prescriptions will be covered under your current health plan and also assess for possible out-of-pocket costs. Sometimes providers can prescribe different medications if some medications are not necessarily covered by your insurance. So we always tell people if something is cost prohibitive to let us know because there might be other options. It's always important to identify the personal needs of the patient. Do you need additional care outside of your primary oncologist? Does your caregiver or family require additional support, and what does that look like? Do you require mental health care, and does your family require mental health care? Do you require palliative care? Palliative care involves symptom management and psychosocial support to really promote your quality of life. If you're at a cancer center, you probably have heard the words palliative care, but it's definitely a referral that you can ask for to get some additional support. In addition to medical care, you might need social or psychosocial support, help with meals, or assistance with transportation. You also want to evaluate the location of these services. Are you able to get there quickly? Long rides might be uncomfortable for the patient, and they also might not be feasible for family, friends, and caregivers to get you to appointments. So to improve quality of life, finding care close to home might be a priority for you. When we talk about social and psychosocial support, do you prefer in-person support or support via technology, like a phone call or a video call? When seeking out support, it's important to understand what a support group might look like and why it can be helpful for some people and not helpful for others. For some patients, they may not want to see people that are doing much better than them, and alternatively might not want to see people that are doing much worse than they are. You also want to help leverage personal networks to help identify trusted services. And what does this look like? This might be asking a friend who they've used in the past for social work support or who they've used to get a ride maybe to appointments. It's really important to understand what your priorities are, and that can help to choose the right community resources for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bosky. And our next speaker is Danielle Hunter, and Ms. Hunter is Staff Attorney, Standby Guardianship Project, Cancer Advocacy Project Legal Health, New York Legal Assistance Group. And Ms. Hunter will be discussing learning how to appeal insurance, Medicare, and provider denials. I'm now going to hand the workshop over to Ms. Hunter.
Thank you so much, Johnny. As mentioned, my name is Danielle, and I'm a staff attorney at the New York Legal Assistance Group, and I'm very, very pleased to be a part of this incredible workshop with Cancer Care. Today, as Johnny mentioned, I'm going to be speaking about insurance appeals. To understand health coverage and appeals rights, it's super important to know that there are different types of insurance plans. For example, there are private insurances, which include group plans from employment and unions. There are policies available through the Affordable Care Act, also called the ACA, via the state marketplace. And of course, there's also Medicare and Medicaid. The type of plan that you or your loved one has is going to determine the type of laws and rules that apply regarding coverage, eligibility, and appeal rights. The insurance laws of your state may also require certain minimum benefits, so your rights may also vary depending on where you live. Some plans are subject only to federal law, while other plans are subject to both federal and state law. As a start, the most important advice I can give is to read a copy of your insurance policy for your appeal rights. You can also contact your insurance company directly with any questions about the appeal process and your rights for appeals. Generally, your insurance company is required to provide an explanation of benefit, or an EOB, for each claim. The EOB outlines the service, amount paid by your insurance, your required contribution, and, if your claim is denied, the reason for the denial. you have the right to request a full copy of your insurance file prior to an appeal to see how the decision was made. This insurance file could also include notes made by the case handler and any reports by the insurance company doctor. Sometimes claims are denied for administrative reasons that are easy to fix. You should email or call your insurer to keep track of any correspondence by writing down the date and name of the representative you spoke with. If the matter cannot be resolved this way, you can also file an appeal. After reading your policy, clearly document in writing the reasons that you disagree with the decision made by the insurance company. In this appeal, you should also include medical records and a letter from your doctor if possible to obtain. Your insurance company must conduct a full and fair review of its decision within 30 days. If you are worried that your insurance company is not complying with the law or the terms of the policy, you can file a complaint with your state insurance department, the Attorney General's office, or the Department of Labor, depending on whether your plan is subject to state law only or both state and federal law. If your insurance company denies the appeal, you have the right to request an external review. This is a second level of appeal to an independent panel, no matter where you live and what type of health insurance you have. This means that medical professionals with no financial stake in the claim make this decision. If the external reviewer overturns your insurer's denial, your insurer must provide the payments or services in your claim. A great resource for help with appealing health insurance plan denials is communityhealthadvocates.org. This is a free service that helps people get, use, and keep their health insurance. And I'm going to repeat the URL one more time. It's communityhealthadvocates.org. If you are appealing a Medicare decision, the appeal rules can be complicated. You may want to speak to an expert about your specific case. The Medicare Rights Center is a nonprofit which helps navigate these complexities. They have an interactive and very, very helpful website at medicarerights.org. Again, to repeat, that's medicarerights.org. You can also visit medicare.gov for more information. And to repeat that one as well, that's medicare.gov. It is important to pay attention to timing when filing an appeal, as there are very strict deadlines which are indicated in the denial notice. Usually the deadline is around 180 days if you have a policy from an employer, but it can be as little as 60 days with denials from Medicaid or Medicare. The good news is that around half of all denied claims that are appealed are eventually reversed. External review reversal rates are even higher. It's often difficult to keep on top of insurance matters with so much else going on, but with an understanding of what your rights and responsibilities are, which you can understand by reading your policy, as well as help from your medical team, government resources, and groups such as Cancer Care and the National Cancer Legal Services Network, you should be able to navigate any insurance issues or questions that come up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danielle. And our next speaker is Michelle McCourt. And Ms. McCourt is the Executive Director of Cancer Care's Co-Payment Assistance Foundation. And Ms. McCourt will be discussing finding the practical help you need, co-pay foundations, federal, state, and local programs. Now I'm going to hand the workshop over to Ms. McCourt.
Thank you, Johnny, for the introduction. I am Michelle McCourt, and I am the Executive Director of Cancer Care's Co-Payment Assistance Foundation. Cancer is an expensive illness, and even with insurance, many patients face access and affordability barriers that negatively impact their ability to start or stay on treatment. This is referred to as underinsured, meaning you have insurance, but the out-of-pocket costs required by your plan make it nearly impossible to access the treatments prescribed by the physician. There are co-payment assistance programs available that can help. These programs are designed to address the financial needs of insured patients by offering assistance with co-payments, co-insurance, and premiums that can be a barrier. These programs serve as a safety net for patients who have no other alternative resources for assistance. There are different types of co-payment assistance programs. Some are administered through the pharmaceutical company, and others are administered through an independent nonprofit organization or foundation like Cancer Care. Eligibility for these programs vary depending on the diagnosis, treatment, and the type of insurance coverage they have. Patients with private commercial insurance, such as insurance offered through an employer, may be eligible for a manufactured patient assistance program. This type of program may provide a coupon where the most you might pay for your prescription is $25, or they may offer a copayment card to be used for payment when they purchase their prescription and have a zero copay. Manufacturer patient assistance programs help with the brand name medications and are usually offered when there is no generic drug equivalent available and the medication prescribed is manufactured by that drug company. There is usually an income criteria that has to be met, and only patients with private commercial insurance are eligible to apply. Patients with federal insurance, such as Medicare or Medicaid, are not eligible for this type of program. For patients with no insurance, the drug company may offer a patient assistance program that will provide the drug free. To learn about these programs, you can contact the drug company who makes the medication to find out about their patient support programs. A simple internet search using the name of the medication should bring you to the medication website, which will provide information on resources. Other programs that offer financial assistance are through a copayment assistance foundation, such as Cancer Care. Copayment assistance foundations are administered by independent nonprofit organizations and are not affiliated with the drug company. These programs have specific financial, medical, and insurance criteria that need to be met. The funds offered are disease-specific, not drug-specific. And if eligible, the foundation will provide financial assistance to help with the out-of-pocket costs for deductibles, copays, and coinsurance for the medications used to treat the disease. For example, to be eligible for our copayment assistance through Cancer Care, the primary cancer diagnosis must match one of the funds that we have open. The household income must be at or below 500% of the federal poverty level. The patient must have insurance that is covering a portion of the medication prescribed. Some funds are restricted to only patients insured through a federal health insurance plan, such as Medicare or a Medicare Advantage plan, and TRICARE, which is military insurance. Patient must be in active treatment or have a prescription to start treatment. Patient must be a U.S. citizen or legal resident of the U.S. and U.S. territories. To review the list of funds we support and current status, you can go online to our website at cancercarecopay.org. From there, you can review the eligibility criteria and start the enrollment process. If a fund is closed, you can register to receive an email notification for when the fund is open. Along with Cancer Care's foundation, there are approximately 8 other national copay foundations. The best way to find out about all of these programs is to discuss these financial concerns with your healthcare team, who can connect you with a financial counselor or a social worker. You can call Cancer Care and speak with one of our resource navigators. You can also visit our website, cancercare.org, and access our Helping Hand online resource database. This is a tool that can help you find national and local resources that offer financial assistance. Please keep in mind that these foundations rely on donations and are limited based on the amount of funding that's available. If you have been referred to a foundation or notified that a fund is open, get in touch with them right away to start the application process. Funds will open and close quickly at various times throughout the year. I also want to discuss Medicare, Medicaid, and recent changes that went into effect last year for Medicare Part D. D as in David. Medicare is a federal health insurance program for people ages 65 or older, or for those under 65 that are disabled and receiving Social Security disability. Medicaid is state assistance offered to people with low incomes. The criteria to receive Medicaid varies by each state. Medicare Part D is the prescription drug benefit offered to Medicare enrollees. A Part D plan can be purchased in addition to regular Medicare, or it is a prescription benefit included through a Medicare Advantage plan. Last year, in 2025, there was an update to Part D, and prescription costs are now capped at $2,100 for the year. In addition, there is also the Medicare prescription payment plan offered to Part D enrollees. The payment plan is optional and designed to help people prescribed expensive specialty medications, help them spread out their costs over the calendar year. Once enrolled in the plan will pay the pharmacy for the copay, and the patient will have a zero copay when they pick up the prescription. The patient will then receive a monthly statement from the Part D plan to pay them back directly throughout the calendar year. So instead of having to pay a high copay to the pharmacy at time of purchase, the payments are spread out over the course of the year and paid to the Part D plan. There are definite benefits to this program and should be explored by the beneficiary to determine if the prescription payment plan is an option. More information can be found on the Medicare website at medicare.gov. There is also various Medicare savings programs that can help with costs. These are state-run programs based on income and assets that help with Medicare premiums and copays. Each state is different, but generally the income requirement is at or below 135% of the federal poverty level. More information can be found on your state's government website. These programs can help with the Medicare Part B premiums and the 20% coinsurance not covered by Medicare Part B. There is also Part D extra help that can lower Medicare prescription drug costs, like premiums, deductibles, and coinsurance. And if eligible for this program, the most you may have to pay for a prescription is $12.65. We realize this is a lot of information, and when you are already stressful in a stressful situation, such as dealing with a cancer diagnosis, it can be overwhelming. Again, let your healthcare team know if you are experiencing difficulties paying for treatments. They can connect you with patient navigators, social workers, or financial counselors who can help navigate and access these resources. Thank you, and I will turn it back over to Johnny.
Thank you very much, Ms. McCourt. Okay, and our final speaker is Melissa Cyrus, and Ms. Cyrus is the Long Island Program Coordinator as well as an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Cyrus will be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services, as well as our Hope Line and website. I'm delighted to hand it over to Ms. Cyrus.
Thank you, Johnny. And I just want to say I'm appreciative for this opportunity to be part of this knowledgeable panel and talk about cancer care services. As previously stated, my name is Melissa Cyrus. I'm an oncology social worker and the Long Island Program Manager here at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. To become connected to any of Cancer Care services, those interested can call Cancer Care's National Hope Line to speak to an oncology social worker at 1-800-813-4673. Caring for your loved one that is experiencing a cancer diagnosis or other health issues can be overwhelming. Additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a supportive network, may help to relieve feelings of anxiety. It can be beneficial to determine ways to approach these challenges that may surface. Working one-on-one with an oncology social worker through individual counseling can offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. If you are in need of emotional support as a caregiver, please feel free to reach out to our Hope Line and we can help explore your options for support. In addition, Cancer Care's resource navigation services are offered nationally to not just patients and post-treatment survivors, but also caregivers affected by cancer. We offer a short-term, strength-based approach to resource navigation, where resource navigators will work with you in connecting to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Whether you need practical, financial, or emotional support, our navigators can help provide you with resources to meet your needs. And on Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, there is also a wide array of reading material and information related to caring for a loved one that is experiencing a cancer diagnosis. This includes recorded Connect education workshops, Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, publications about coping with a cancer diagnosis or your role as a caregiver, as well as stories of help and hope, among many other resources. I hope the information provided is helpful, and I will pass it over to Johnny.
Thank you very much, Melissa. And then just a note, before we move on to the Q&A, I want to say that we covered a lot of information today, and many resources were mentioned throughout the call. I don't want people listening, our participants live on the webinar right now, to be concerned about writing everything down or that you're going to lose this information. In about a week to 2 weeks, we'll send an email to everyone who has registered that will have every resource listed from this workshop on it. So don't feel as if you have to write everything down or that it's lost, because it'll be in that email, and the workshop will be up on the website for at least a year if you'd like to come back and listen to it. Okay, and now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Great, thank you, Bella. A question here for Ms. Hunter. It's just a comment regarding appeals being 30 days. If the issue is urgent, can you request an expedited appeal where a decision can be made within 72 hours?
Yeah, thank you for your question. I think this will depend on your specific policy. So I really encourage you to read your policy to see what your appeal rights are. And if you still have questions, to reach out to the communityhealthadvocates.org website to see if they can assist you with it as well.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hunter. We have a question here for Dr. Kent. My brother was recently diagnosed with cancer, and he's 35 years old. He lives alone, and I live in a different state about 300 miles away. What can I do to assist long distance?
That's a great question. And I think the first thing that I would probably do is try to have a discussion with my sibling about their goals and preferences to see what they first and foremost would want the most. And then I would try to use available tools that I have at a distance to try to help meet those needs as best as I can. So it really depends on what this so much of the situation and what is needed, but definitely trying to activate local resources that are on hand are going to be important. It just is going to depend on whatever are the most pressing needs that your brother might have. So if it's needs related to sort of helping your brother's household or family, they're sort of keeping those things sort of tended to, or versus if they're more around helping your brother sort of go through cancer care. But either way, really trying to activate a network based on what those preferences are, and trying to find anybody that's sort of, that is local and supporting them is a really good way. So sort of thinking of yourself as a deputy to that person that might be in place. Now, if there really is no one there, then I think, thinking about how to get some formal support during times of the treatment that that your brother might really need that sort of on-site support. So if there's a way to spend some of that time there with him, that can be really great. But if not, then trying to find if there's actually going to be some need to help him with getting to appointments, spending time with him during those appointments, being able to ask questions of the healthcare team. And then, at a distance, there's a lot that can be organized through programs such as Caring Bridge or Lots of Helping Hands to try to activate some of the support networks at a distance. But really, it's about goals and preferences that your brother might have.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kent. And we have one more question here for Dr. Paulos. I'm having trouble deciding having my father live in an assisted living facility. Do you have any advice for families making this decision?
That is a very difficult decision to make. I think one of the first things that you can do is have a family meeting and invite. You can decide whether or not you'd like your father to be there or not. But that way, if you have other siblings, you can kind of see how they feel about it. Because what I have found, my experience is that many times everyone thinks they're going to agree, and then they find out, no, they're not going to agree. And then talk to your father, just, you know, say, find out, would he feel comfortable? Would he be happy there? Would it, you know, make a difference to him to be surrounded by his favorite types of things that he's used to, or would he be willing to move somewhere else and feel, you know, knowing that he's getting really good care, but knowing that he is going to be in an unfamiliar place for a while? It's a hard decision, and you're not going to make it in 24 hours, I would usually, that's what I usually found. 24 hours decisions for that type of thing is very hard. So have your meetings. Family meetings are the best. You can even do it by, we've had them where we've had people coming in on FaceTime or Zoom. So there's some creative ways to do some of that long distance caregiver information that we heard earlier. So I hope that helped, but there's not really a yes, you know, it's a good decision, or no, it's not a good decision. It depends on the preferences. And the other thing are the financial resources that are available. Are there insurance to cover that? Are there other ways to cover the expenses for that? So I appreciate you asking that question. That is a hard question.
Thank you very much, Dr. Palos. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. So just a brief takeaway to conclude the call. We'll start with Dr. Kent, then Dr. Ritchie, Dr. Palos, then Ms. Bosky, Ms. Hunter, Ms. McCourt, and then Ms. Cyrus. So Dr. Kent.
Just thank you for listening today. I think there's so many complicated issues with in caring for someone with cancer, either at a distance or even on site. So there's a lot of resources to think about. Think about your care recipient's goals and preferences, and think about your own as well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kent. And Dr. Ritchie?
Yeah, I think regarding my topic, it's really important that you are not afraid to be an advocate for the patient that's going through cancer treatment. It's okay to ask questions and to stay organized and understand that it is complicated, but it is best to stay organized and take notes and ask those questions.
Thank you very much. Dr. Ritchie and Dr. Palos?
Dr. Ritchie? This is Dr. Palos. If my take-home message is priority to the caregiver. If you feel guilt or it shows up and starts, you know, nagging at you, advocate for yourself and remind yourself, I'm a better caregiver when I'm healthy. You can also get your own little mantra, rest is part of the plan, rest is part of the plan. Or the other could be, doing my best is enough for today. Doing my best is enough for today. Be kind to yourself because it is a hard job. We all know that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Palos. Ms. Bosky?
So I think my takeaway would be to advocate for yourself and for the patient and ask questions. Because like we've said, care is complex, and there are a lot of resources for all kinds of support out there. So just make sure to keep looking if you don't find something that you need right away.
Thank you, Ms. Bosky. Ms. Hunter?
Yeah, thank you all so much for listening. I'll just briefly say that I know insurance appeals can be very daunting and overwhelming, but you have multiple levels of rights afforded to you under state and federal law. And so I really encourage you to read your healthcare policy or the policy of your loved one to best understand what those rights are, similar to what a lot of other people are saying today. I also really encourage you to, you know, not be afraid to advocate for yourself and also to reach out to help. There are plenty of organizations who can provide you specific information about your case and your policy. And I encourage you to reach out to those with any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hunter. Ms. McCourt?
Thank you again for letting me participate in this. I think it was a very informative session. And again, I would just reiterate that you should You know, if you're experiencing difficulties paying for treatments or affording your care, talking to your healthcare team about those difficulties is the best place to start. Again, they can connect you with patient navigators or social workers or financial counselors within the facility that you're already going to, but there are a lot of resources nationally that are available as well, and cancer care is a great resource to start to tap into. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCourt and Ms. Cyrus.
Thank you, Johnny. Just as a reminder, caregiving is not meant to be done alone. Building connections with supports, resources, and community can reduce stress and improve outcomes for both caregivers and loved ones. Today's workshop highlighted that informed, supportive caregivers are better equipped to navigate challenges with confidence and compassion, and it's important just to prioritize yourself as the caregiver. Wellness is not selfish. It's essential for sustainable and compassionate care, so just taking care of yourself and seeking support is important. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cyrus. I just want to take a moment to thank all of our speakers. We had a phenomenal panel today, and I want to thank our participants for staying on and for listening. Today's program was exceptional because of the questions that were asked and the way that our speakers addressed those questions. I do want to say a few words for those of you that didn't have your question answered, or if you did, I want you to go back to your healthcare team and ask them your questions. Please remember that you've learned a great deal from today's program, so I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your question again and again. Lastly, I just want to say I don't want anyone to leave this program feeling as if they are alone. Just to echo what most of our speakers have said today, you are not alone. You have a community here at Cancer Care. We are here to help you. Again, I appreciate everyone's participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.